This is episode 344 with health and human performance coach and researcher who's worked with teams like the England football team and four-time European champ, the Lone Star rugby team, Dr. Peter Tierney. Welcome to the Strength Running Podcast. I'm your host, Coach Jason Fitzgerald, and my singular goal is to help you improve your running by getting stronger, racing faster, preventing more injuries, and achieving more of your goals. I'm a former cross-country and track athlete for Connecticut College, a columnist for Trail Runner magazine, and a 239 marathoner. And at one time, I was a proud steeplechaser. You can learn more about me and strength running at strengthrunning.com. And I could not continue this show without the support of our partners. I hope you'll take advantage of the discounts that they're offering. I am so grateful for the support of AG1, the health and wellness company that makes comprehensive daily nutrition super simple. Now, I am a man of convenience, which means I don't always choose the healthiest foods. But I also know that I need my body firing on all cylinders to be the best coach, runner, podcast host, and dad that I can be. So I'm finding their product, AG1, really helpful to help optimize my health by giving my body what it needs. You can learn more about it at drinkag1.com/Jason. One scoop gives me 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food sourced ingredients, including a green superfood blend, probiotics, prebiotics, adaptogens, and more. AG1 helps me fill in any nutrition gaps in my diet, because let's face it, my friends, there are some gaps, and it gives me a nice boost of energy and focus throughout the day. And with three kids in elementary school, I know I've got to support my immune system because I'm no match for little kid germs. But what I really love about AG1 is that it changes. Over the last decade, they've made over 50 different improvements to the formula based on the latest research so that there are more nutrients and they are more available for your body to absorb. AG1 is certified for quality and safety by NSF International and is NSF certified for sport, meaning it does not contain any of the more than 270 substances that are banned by professional sports organizations. Go to drinkag1.com/Jason to see the great offer they've put together for our podcast listeners. You're going to get a year's worth of free vitamin D and 5 free travel packs of AG1 with your first purchase. You can sign up for a single shipment or for a monthly drop if you want to make AG1 a part of your regular healthy lifestyle. Go to drinkag1.com/Jason to sign up today. Don't miss the Performance Training Journal, now available on Amazon. Now, since I started running back in 1998, I've kept a hard copy training journal, holding a tangible log, writing in it daily, and reflecting on the ups and downs of running is a surefire way to improve. You'll learn how to focus on the training metrics that matter, prioritize optimism in your running, focus on long-term progress, and reflect on what's actually helping you run faster. I've used my conversations with elite runners to inform what's included in the journal. You'll focus on what helps you improve, period. With a no-frills functional design, the Performance Training Journal includes coaching advice on racing, injury prevention, strength training, and more. It will guide you through race scheduling, how to plan your race morning, the best workouts for endurance runners, and encourage you to track your personal bests over time. Maybe most importantly, you have the space to make this journal your own, whether you're a new runner or a professional, a trail or road runner, a mid-distance specialist, or an ultra-marathoner. A detailed, performance-oriented training journal is one of the most effective and valuable training tools at your disposal. Don't just track your running, learn from it with the Performance Training Journal, now available on Amazon. You can also find a link to the journal in the show description. My guest today is Dr. Peter Tierney, a health and performance researcher, consultant, and coach who's worked with many professional sports organizations across Europe, mostly in football, that's soccer for us Americans, and rugby. Peter is an expert in physiology and performance and holds a PhD from University College Dublin. He's worked as a strength and conditioning coach for elite athletes, a sports scientist, and a performance coach. In this conversation, we're doing a deep dive on recovery, and more specifically, Peter's Big Five strategies that have a lot of science behind them. We're going to cover recovery tools like time, sleep, stress reduction, and more, including why they're important, how to focus on the most impactful optimizations, mistakes to avoid, plus insights on not overthinking any of these strategies. By the way, if you're interested in recovery, I asked 9 elite athletes, including runners like David Roche, Amelia Boone, and even Dathan Ritzenhain, about their favorite injury prevention and recovery ideas. You can get all of their feedback at strengthrunning.com/elites. And now, without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Peter Tierney. Dr. Peter Tierney, thank you for making the time today.
Thanks, Jason, for inviting me to have a chat today.
Well, I'm excited. Where are we finding you today?
So I'm in Vancouver in Canada. Relocated here about 2.5 years ago, just over 2 years ago. From Ireland, if you can probably tell by the strong accent, and have spent some time in the UK as well. But yeah, currently in Vancouver.
All right. Well, I am half Irish, so you've got your fellow Irishman over here. Maybe we can try to talk in kilometers rather than miles, this imperial system that we use down here.
That'd be great. Although I've had a lot of recent experience with quick conversions from miles to kilometers, back to miles, paces, and everything else. So reasonably comfortable with both. But yeah, kilometers is the preference.
Yeah, we'll try to avoid any public math today. But we're going to talk a lot about recovery. So maybe we won't be talking about specific distances and rep schemes and workouts and things like that. You know, recovery is one of those things that I love talking about, because, you know, it's almost just as important as the training itself. Because if you're not recovering from it, you almost might as well not be doing it in the first place. And what I thought would be interesting is to almost rank a variety of recovery strategies, starting with the most impactful. But before we even get to that, how would you even define recovery? It just seems to be this abstract, always occurring phenomenon. So I'm curious if you have a good definition for it.
Oh, good question. I think of recovery as like return to a normal state is probably like the shorthand answer. And I guess you could think of that, you know, people think of it as measuring different things or specific strategies. But if you think of recovery as returning to a normal state, that normal state could be a new normal after you've adapted from something, but that's sort of the high level way. But it certainly isn't just about specific strategies. And even a concept that the team that I was on when I worked in England, we sort of coined it as the other 22 hours. So we were really trying to get across the message to coaches and to athletes that recovery is not just what you do immediately after a training session or a competition or a race. It's actually everything you do outside of that activity. We probably have to redefine it to not the other 22 hours for some of the longer endurance folk. It's probably the other 8 hours of the day that some people aren't training, particularly in the sort of triathlon endurance ultra world. But that's sort of how I've have kept thinking about it in that way, is it's behaviors, it's sleep, it's all the things you do outside of your training stimulus.
This reminds me of my college cross-country coach telling us that running is a lifestyle, not just a sport that you do for 2 hours a day. And so that really hits at this idea that what you do in all of the hours around your training is going to be just as important, because that's going to dictate how well you are recovering from the workout, which then dictates how well you're actually adapting to the workout and really absorbing all that hard work. Because you want to make sure that your body is actually changing a little bit, right? We want those adaptations, because that's how we get faster. That's how we gain endurance and get stronger. That's where the magic is right there. And so this conversation is going to be about that lifestyle, those other 22 hours. Maybe for some of those weird ultra runners, it's the other, you know, 16 hours of the day, because they're spending so much time running.
2 hours even potentially. Yeah.
I know, right? So let's talk about some of these strategies. And you've recently published a piece on what you think are the Big Five recovery strategies. And maybe we can start there and just talk about, you know, if you were to say, what's the most important factor that's going to impact my recovery, what might that be?
Yeah, I've said this one a few times. To me, it's actually time. But time is the thing that not a lot of people have. And if we use an endurance runner as an example, if you have a race, if you just wait, you will recover. It might take a long time, but you will recover. What most people don't have the luxury of is time. And that's where all of the other sort of things on top of that become important. And so if you could just recover with time, you know, you would probably only train once a week or twice a week. But, you know, a lot of people are training twice a day or 6-7 times a week, if not more. And so that's where the other strategies become more and more important. And outside of time, of course, like sleep, nutrition, hydration, and even just managing stress overall, I think are those sort of key or like big rocks, those like key principles. And I don't want to diminish the importance of the other things outside of that, like whether it's supplements or massage or active recovery or other things, they're still important. But I think to get those initial sort of concepts in place, have some good habits, they can sort of support the use of some of those other strategies. And sometimes using some of the strategies can also support some of the big rocks as well. So it is, a two-way street. It's not just one or the other, but it is trying to think about all of those things in a more like zoomed out sort of fashion, instead of getting too caught up in this specific thing after this specific race or training session.
I'm glad you brought that up, because even though we're going to confine our conversation to these five strategies, these aren't the only strategies. These are what I might consider the most important strategies, that, you know, these are the fundamental pillars to get right first, before you then start branching out into supplements and things like that. You know, like I think supplements can be quite helpful, but if you're getting 3 hours of sleep, you know, every night, that's just not enough. And the supplement's not really going to make up for the lack of sleep that you're experiencing. So time is something that is something that I just haven't really thought of when it comes to recovery. Like obviously, you know, if you wait 3 weeks, you're not going to feel that marathon in your legs anymore. But when runners think about recovery, we don't usually think about time, because like you said, we're trying to usually get back to training again. And time is the thing we don't have enough of. Is there a way, you know, besides just slowing time down in between our training sessions, which if you know how to do that, Peter, please let me know. Besides that, how can we use time to our advantage? Is there a way of, you know, potentially structuring our training in a certain way? Because it does seem like, you know, maybe just properly structured training is going to take advantage of time as a recovery strategy. But how do you think about that?
It's exactly that. It is time, and sort of, I guess, in that bucket of stress management, timing those sort of really intense or those really demanding types of sessions or races. So, you know, whether that's your race calendar for a year or whether that's just those like harder workouts, making sure that you're giving in sufficient time between those to recover. Particularly for endurance runners and endurance athletes who have high training volumes and like high training loads, some of those lower intensity sessions can act as recovery in between the time of those intervals or those higher effort sessions. So that's exactly it. And I think giving yourself, you know, time to recover. And that's where some of those tools can become useful in like helping understand, okay, are you recovered enough between hard sessions or hard races to sort of, you know, fulfill or adapt properly as you're required. So that's where, you know, HRV tracking or even tracking like, you know, sleep over a longer duration of time or certain health biomarkers can actually help in some of those decision makings, along with the coach, is probably the best way to manage the time between your recovery.
Yeah. And, you know, thinking about this as a coach, this reminds me very much of the concept of training density, you know, like how much quality you're putting in your training. And there's a couple different ways of defining this, but, you know, I like to look at it from an intensity perspective. You know, if your training is too dense, then there are too many intense sessions too close to each other. So you're not allowing for enough time in between those intense sessions. And it's almost like if you don't get the time thing right first, it almost doesn't matter how much you're sleeping or how much you're staying hydrated. You know, after all, you can't do a hard workout every single day. You know, your body needs more time than that. You get every other recovery strategy right, but if time isn't the foundation, all of those other strategies are probably moot.
Yeah, the density is a great point. And I think even in my experience working in like football or soccer, I have to say now that I'm in North America, sometimes, particularly international soccer, the training or the competition density is so high. And that was you know, some of the experience that I've had. And some players are playing 3 fixtures within 7 days. And so, I mean, that's just the nature of the competition. So you can't avoid that. But to your point around density and even recovery, it becomes a different conversation when you're targeting either adaptation or performance. And it's not to say those things are like, you can't have them at the same time, but even at certain parts of a season, whether that's running or field sports or basketball, whatever it is, there are certain points where you're going to prioritize adaptation over performance. And, you know, for soccer, for example, that's an example. In a preseason period, you might have over 2 months, for example, that's a period where you prioritize adaptation. And performance isn't the most crucial thing at that point. It always is. But as you know, you get towards a competition or a knockout stages or whatever that might be, that's where performance sort of trumps adaptation. And even, you know, that conversation happens all the time with recovery strategies, like the cold water immersion sort of conversation comes up every time I open Instagram or social media and stuff. And, you know, that's a tool that has divided a lot of opinion across a lot of different athletes and coaches. But it's a tool I think has a use case in certain situations, depending on like the outcome and whether that is performance or adaptation.
Yeah, I think a really good example of when you're focusing on adaptation versus performance is like the classic ultra marathoner training camp, where for 3 to 4 days, they might essentially do a long run every day. You know, they're getting out in the mountains or on the trails and, you know, they're, you know, engaging with their all day pace. And they're just spending a lot of time on their feet. And they do this for 3 to 4 days in a row with the goal of super compensation and just stressing the body a lot. And you give yourself more recovery afterwards and you come back as a much more robust runner. But you're not really trying to perform very well in that environment. And you certainly wouldn't want to do that a week before your goal race when the focus is performance. So I think that might be a helpful way of sort of conceptualizing both for our listeners.
100%. Even sleep as an example of sort of adaptation versus recovery and performance. Like, you can perform well on limited sleep. And I think you'll see that across multiple sports, whether that's like ultra running or even basketball, for example. Like, top NBA players are traveling across the country on limited sleep and performing to incredibly high levels. The same with ultra runners, or different events happen late at night or early in the morning. But so from a performance perspective, that can happen. But long term, obviously, you do need sufficient sleep for like adaptation and long term health as well.
I think every marathoner gets that because they get crap sleep the night before their race because they're nervous. And, you know, it's like Christmas morning. You wake up an hour before your alarm clock. You know, it's 2:30 in the morning or something terrible like that. But you go and you have a good race and it's still possible because you don't need, like you said, you don't need a ton of sleep for a good performance if it's short-term sleep loss. So it sounds like for runners to get this aspect of their recovery right, it's a focus on distributing their training a little bit more intelligently so that they don't need to layer on every single recovery strategy in the book to come back from something that they maybe shouldn't have done in the first place. Maybe doing 2 workouts back-to-back days or something similar to that, which was just too stressful in the first place.
Yeah. And I mean, I've even seen some strategies from coaches and athletes who might prioritize doing 2 sessions in the same day, but to give themselves almost a full day off or of recovery or very, very low intensity training, as opposed to distributing it sort of every day across the week. And, you know, as a strategy, that probably gives you a little bit more time between harder workouts as a concept. And I've seen some like a little bit of evidence for that as well. So it obviously depends on, you know, individual approaches and backgrounds and stuff. But I do think, yeah, that intensity of like training, people can probably do a little bit more than they think. And sometimes it's a little bit less, but that's where it's like down to your coach and your individual approach of like actually assessing and monitoring some of these things. And if you start to see a downward trend of soreness or fatigue or mood or even motivation to train, I think that's sort of your indication to say, okay, I'm probably not giving myself enough time between sort of harder workouts, or I'm not recovering as well, or there are other stresses in my life that have come up that are sort of preventing me from adapting or recovering well. And I think the biggest thing is just to not dig yourself a hole too deep that you can't get out of. And, you know, not to be afraid to adjust training intensity if you have to, or to rearrange training density or distribution of harder sessions. I think just being agile in those approaches with yourself or your coach, and just being realistic in terms of, like, you know, at the end of the day, if you're not a professional runner who can dedicate his or her entire day to, or entire week to running, you will have other stresses. If you're a parent, if you're, you have a different job, if you have, if, I don't know, you're sitting in traffic, your commute, all these different things can contribute to, you know, how you recover from everything.
Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely one of those things where, you know, even as a running coach who partly makes his living by writing training plans, you know, I'll be the first one to say that a training plan is written in pencil and it should be modified over time, but it does give you that good template of, this is generally how things should look. But, you know, I also think too that it might be a little harder for the beginner runner to understand or figure out that rhythm of training that is sustainable for them. So it does come with a little bit of trial and error. You know, you're going to overreach and dig yourself into a little bit of a hole. Maybe you get a niggle. Maybe you just are super tired for a couple days. But through some trial and error, you're going to be able to find what works for you. And after maybe 2-3 years of running, you're going to be much better at figuring out this training density issue and what you can handle.
Definitely. And I think, like, the other thing to add on that is, we say, okay, you should be, you know, adjusting your training to lifestyle stressors, but it also goes the other way around. If you have a training program, you know, you might adjust your sort of social or lifestyle habits around that. For example, if you're deciding to have a dinner out with friends or family, you might plan to have that not the night before an intense training session. You might plan to have it the night after. And, like, so these sort of, like, adjustments in your life, whether you're an elite runner or a beginner or novice or whatever level, like, those things I think do go both ways. And to your point around, like, beginner runners or more novice athletes, you know, the expectation is, like, sometimes you should be sore. You don't always have to be fresh when you're running and doing workouts. And, you know, I worked in rugby for a number of years, and the freshest time that we ever had with athletes, when a lot of them hit, you know, max speed personal bests, was when they came back from off season, because they just had 3 weeks of not getting, you know, physically battered in contact. And so that was, you know, people were surprised. They're like, I haven't done much training. How am I so fast? And I was like, well, just because you're fresh and you haven't been physically tortured for a couple of weeks in a row.
Yeah, I'm laughing over here because I just can't imagine a rugby player ever feeling too fresh. You know, if they're training the way a rugby game looks, you know, they're sort of always going to be beat up, aren't they?
Oh, the whole way through the season is pretty much a level of sort. But I mean, like I said, they're still recovering enough to perform to an exceptionally high level. You can still adapt, but it's having that awareness and, like, understanding that you can still do things, you know, with a little bit of soreness. Obviously not to a dangerous point, but there's a level of acceptance that you get with experience in the sport.
Right. And it's a good point too, that, you know, these modifications to training go both ways. There can also be modifications to your lifestyle. And I think a lot of runners start running and they start falling in love with it. Hey, this is fun. I'm going to start registering for these races. And then some of their other lifestyle habits become healthier in support of their running. So I like this idea that it's a two-way street. You can certainly eat healthier and get more sleep at night. Maybe you can't reduce stress by, you know, giving up your kids for adoption, but, you know, there's certain things that we can do, right?
Definitely, yeah. 100% agree.
Now let's talk about what most runners think is the number one recovery strategy, which is sleep. I think everyone knows that you've got to sleep a lot. So I don't really want to talk about the benefits of sleep or what sleep is going to get you as a runner. I think that's somewhat self-explanatory. What I would like to ask you is, what are some of your favorite ways of getting better sleep, and where might athletes be focusing on the wrong thing when it comes to sleep? Are we trying to get too much sleep, or are we doing things that we might think are helpful but are actually negatively contributing to our sleep? You know, how do we get our sleep right?
Yeah, one of the things is probably overthinking it, in a crude way of saying that, like, you know, a lot of people probably sleep enough and probably sleep well enough that they don't have to worry. And if you know, if you fit into one of those, if that bucket of you sleep well enough and long enough, then, you know, that's great. Some people might be very envious of that. But that's, you know, you can fit into that category. One of the most, I guess, successful strategies, like, and like we said, irrespective of obviously the things that everyone should be aware of, like the importance of sleep, is with athletes that have worked in the past and even still do, brain dumping as a term or as a tactic seems to have like very good success. And what I mean by brain dumping is, I guess, literally dumping the thoughts out of your brain, like before you go to bed, as part of a wind down routine. And particularly with athletes, this is in field sports, but also runners and probably everyone in general. You always have a lot of thoughts going through your mind, like, well, what am I to do tomorrow? I've set this alarm. I'm getting up to do this training session. I'm going to work. I've got to get my kids to school or whatever the, you know, everyday things that you do are. And often for me personally, but also my experience with athletes, that's, they come to your mind just as you're going to sleep, when, you know, when you've finished everything else. And what I like to say is, if you can write those things down physically on paper, you have the confidence that, okay, you've emptied your brain, but also you haven't forgotten anything for the next day. Because often with athletes, and particularly this happened in field sports and football and soccer and rugby, they're like, oh, I have to remember to do this thing tomorrow. They'd wake up in the middle of the night, kind of almost in a panic to say, oh, I have to remember to recover well tomorrow and eat this and do this. But if you wake up in the middle of the night knowing that you have everything written down beside you, it sort of gives a level of ease to your mind and to your sleep. So surprisingly, I found that to be a very successful tactic. Obviously, assuming the sort of rock, you know, consistency and duration are all sort of there in place already.
You know, one of the most helpful strategies I've come across for getting better sleep is to have a consistent wake up time, which is a little bit different than having a consistent bedtime. Because if you have a consistent wake up time, you can always work backward and say, okay, if I want 7 hours of sleep or 8 hours of sleep, I can just go to bed at this time. And it introduces this level of consistency to your schedule that I think is almost part of this like brain dumping idea too. Like you're just taking this thing off your plate, off your mental plate. I don't have to worry about what time I'm going to get up tomorrow. It's the same every day. Your body finds that rhythm. You know, one of the things that I struggle with personally is that some of my days look very different than other days. So I might get up at 6 a.m. one day, and then the next day I'll sleep in until 7:30. And I found that freedom isn't actually very freeing, because it almost throws off your rhythm. And I think one of the most beneficial things for a distance runner is to have a good rhythm, to have a good schedule so that they can be consistent with their training. And for me, it was super helpful just to have a more consistent wake up time.
Definitely. And I also think if you have, I think I posted this before, a sort of a visual to try represent this, but if you have one bad night of sleep, or if you do sleep in longer than you normally do for one night, and it's not a consistent thing, like I always remind people to zoom out a little bit and, you know, not to worry too much. Because I think some people, if you wake up, for example, early tomorrow morning, or, you know, you're up later than usual, you can get very anxious about, oh, I've missed out on, you know, 90 minutes of sleep. Like, what am I going to do? I have to catch up on this. And often the best thing to do is just do nothing. Just continue your day as normal. You might be a little bit more sleepy. You might be a little bit more hungry potentially, but, you know, go to bed the same time as you normally do the next night, you know, carry on as if nothing has happened. And over the course of 7 days or 28 days or 3 months, you know, that small blip in a reduced total sleep time on average is actually nothing. It's very insignificant. So that's often something that I remind people.
This is like not overthinking your sleep, right? So, you know, if you get 8.5 hours tonight, you know, you're not going to be Superman tomorrow. Just like if you get 7.5 hours tonight, you're probably going to be just fine anyway. And so it's just a helpful way of not overthinking things so that you can just get on the business of getting on with your life, right?
Yeah, 100%. And like the other thing, which I think is important to mention, and I think hopefully everyone sort of listening to this is aware of just the importance of your environment, your bedroom environment, and setting that up. So setting your room for success. So it being like temperature, dark enough, and also just, to me personally, also just having it as just the place that you sleep. So not like working from bed or not, you know, not associating it with a place of like high stress. So it's similar to your point, like your body and your brain will get used to associating a place or an environment with something. And so as long as that's, you know, winding down or sleeping, I think that's an important consideration as well. So as well as sort of the light, the environment, the temperature, the air quality as well, but that sort of mindset of having bedroom is for sleep is important as well.
Yeah, I have long thought that having a television in your bedroom was a terrible thing. And I am now 40. I have never had a TV in my room, and I want to try to keep it that way. But what are some of your best tips for kind of setting up your bedroom for success? You mentioned temperature. My understanding is that it's better to sleep when it's slightly cooler than slightly warmer. You know, do you favor a sound machine, blackout curtains? Like, what are some real practical suggestions for building a bedroom that is really conducive to good, deep sleep?
Yeah. Darkness, definitely, if you can. Now, I, at the moment, the blinds in my bedroom do not fulfill that for me. So it has, at a certain point of the year, it has woken me up, because between two buildings in Vancouver that I live in, there's a slither of sunlight that wakes me up in the summer at 4 a.m. And I just, every time I'm like, I need to fix this. And I just keep putting it off. So I don't follow my own advice. But yeah, certainly like blackout blinds, that type of thing, dim lighting as well can certainly help. And temperature, like I'll always try leave the window open, or, you know, depending on where you live, that might not be possible or it might be too warm. So trying to get a cool, you know, 30 minutes, 60 minutes before I go to bed, is something that I try to do. And then, I mean, even just bedding, like trying to get a quality mattress for me is just like, people say like, oh, where's the like scientific evidence for that? And I'm like, I think just for me is like the anecdote is like, you know, I'll invest money in a good bed and a good mattress because I know it's going to help me sleep, and I know the benefits for that are going to come longer term. So there are definitely some of those, just the really easy things, I think. Noise, again, I think it depends on where you live. We have like good windows that are like relatively soundproof. So like, I don't hear too much noise from outside the city, despite being a light enough sleeper. I have used sort of white noise in the past. When I was living in London, it was pretty noisy. So I kind of had to have a little bit of background noise to keep me from like jolting awake from sort of loud noises. So that's really useful. You can get some sort of like free apps that you can just play, you know, on your phone or on an iPad through the night. They can certainly be helpful.
Yeah, I use the Rain app on my phone, and I like to combine the Mississippi at night with a rain sound. And so it feels like I'm camping. It feels like I'm outside. I hear crickets and little chirping noises and the rain. You can actually choose one rain sound, which is rain on a tent. So that really makes me feel like I'm outside camping.
And it's so specific.
Yeah, it's so specific. It's very peaceful. I find it. Hey, a quick break to thank our partner, AG1, the high-nutrient probiotic drink that helps you cover all of your nutrition bases. I love this stuff. AG1 is the most popular greens mix available, with 75 vitamins and minerals, prebiotics, probiotics, antioxidants, and adaptogens. To make taking control of your health even easier, AG1 is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune system-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. You can't be fast if you're not first healthy. And so many runners have reported positive benefits from extra recovery to lower heart rates. Visit drinkag1.com/Jason, and you can choose from a single purchase or a monthly subscription for those ready to make this part of your ongoing nutrition plan. See all the details at drinkag1.com/Jason. And a quick thanks to our very own Performance Training Journal, which is now available on Amazon and debuted as the number 4 new release in the running category. I've always loved the visceral feeling of holding a hard copy training journal in your hands, and writing in it daily can improve your motivation and help you learn more about yourself as a runner. The journal helps you focus on the training metrics that matter while ignoring those that don't. It also prioritizes a long-term outlook so you don't take any shortcuts, and it maintains your motivation with strategic self-praise. I've also included example training weeks from some of my personal best weeks during my career, tips on injury prevention and strength training, and more. Get your copy of the Performance Training Journal today on Amazon with the link in the show's description. Let's transition to nutrition. Nutrition is another big recovery strategy. I think for most of my running career, I interpreted that as eat as much as possible. It doesn't matter what. Was I correct in that, Peter?
You're probably better that strategy than other ones that I've seen. As in, you know, I'd almost, personally anyway, I think eating as much as you can is better than not eating enough from like an adaptation perspective, like avoiding low energy availability, you know, not only for performance, but just for health. I think that is important. But certainly, hopefully it's a little bit more dialed now in terms of, you know, matching your sort of caloric needs or performance needs as well. Obviously for like endurance running, the carbohydrate need is so high. And I'm hoping that everybody listening to this and in the running sphere and even in other spheres, like we had this sort of issue or problem in football where, you know, some people are seeing some things online about, oh, like low carbohydrate diets and stuff. And they're sort of bringing that into it, a training camp with us and asking us and nutritionists saying like, oh, I saw this online. And we're like, yeah, but that's for a very specific person or type of person. You're an elite athlete here. You need carbohydrates for, this is in soccer, for higher intensity and the amount of training that you're doing. So I think for a runner now, you need quite a high carbohydrate intake that matches your sort of expenditure in your training sessions. And to even connect it to our sort of conversation around density or training intensity, typically those higher intensity sessions require have a higher carbohydrate demand. So, you know, you can sort of periodize your own week of like fluctuating higher and lower carbohydrate days based on the type of training you're doing. You also, of course, need like a healthy amount of fats and like micronutrients, and then protein, of course, just from a repair and recovery perspective from like a muscle tissue. And hopefully most, if not all runners are doing some elements of strength training, resistance training. And obviously the protein requirements for that are important just from a recovery and a muscle sort of protein synthesis perspective as well.
Nutrition is one of these topics where, you know, we could probably record like a 6-hour argumentative debate here on different diet strategies and things like that. But I'm encouraged to learn that some of the biggest things to get right is to eat enough, to make sure you're getting enough carbohydrate and enough protein. Those seem to me like the two most important macronutrients for fueling your energy and your exercise, but also from recovering from that exercise too. And, you know, all the other stuff just seems to be like, you know, the strategies that aren't as impactful. Is there anything else that we might be getting wrong with our nutrition that might be negatively impacting our recovery? You know, I'm thinking a little bit more in terms of like, specific diets not giving us what we need, or otherwise just, you know, maybe refueling after certain workouts. Like where's the low hanging fruit that would really help drive the recovery up?
Yeah. I mean, I think some of the nutrition products that are available are making it easier for people to achieve those goals. So like a whey protein powder or vegan protein powder, or, you know, some carbohydrate gels or drinks. Those things, like for me, I'd always encourage, and I think everybody somewhat agrees or hopefully agrees that, like, you know, you have a food first approach with nutrition. So you try like relatively whole foods. I enjoy cooking, and I think most people should have that skill set in their wheelhouse, not to be a professional chef, but just to be able to cook and prepare food, I think is a pretty important life skill for everybody, but particularly for athletes. But it's hard to eat enough food sometimes, which, I mean, even to your initial point, if you're training with an extremely high volume, you know, eating for some people in excess of 4,000 calories a day, for example, in some instances, like it's hard. It's, you just get really full. And that's where some of these like drinks and powders and sort of products can really be of benefit. Also during activity, you can sort of think about recovery, we said, as the other 22 hours, but you can also be recovering from a session within a session. And so if you're taking in carbs during a long run, and you know you've got limited time, like we said before, and recovery before your next long run, well then like the nutrition that you take on board during that run can help you recover faster for your next run. And, you know, in that instance, of course, some people can keep down food and physical whole foods, but for me personally, I'd probably have to use some sort of like carbohydrate gel that's basically just sugar, because I don't want to bring, you know, a am I going to bring a sandwich with me or something, or, you know, a full meal kit on a long run with me? So they're sort of, I think, you know, having a balanced approach of obviously mostly whole foods, but then those products where you sort of make your life a little bit easier. And in terms of different diets, and, you know, people have different choices, whether it's vegan or, you know, pescatarian, vegetarian, whatever it is, I think you can achieve health and performance goals with a variety of different approaches. And I think that just comes down to like your individual preferences, maybe some, you know, just different choices that you have, I think.
I'm glad that you brought up fueling during a training session as a way to enhance the recovery process. Because the way I think about it is like every training session is going to dig you into a certain hole, right? And the longer and harder it is, the deeper that hole. And if it's too much, you're not going to be able to recover. You're not going to get the right adaptation from that stimulus because it was just too high. But if you're fueling during the run, it's almost like someone's thrown a little extra dirt into that hole and it's not getting as deep as you're digging it because, you know, you're not using as much of your onboard fuel stores. You're using some, you know, outside fuel that you're taking in during the run. And that's just going to give you energy, but also spare some energy so that you're not in as deep of a hole. And I think that's an often maybe underlooked recovery strategy. I think one of the things that I'm loving about marathoning in 2024 is that because we're fueling better and a lot of us are wearing these super shoes, we're not in the hole post-marathon the way that we have been in the past. And so runners are, you know, 3-4 days later, their legs don't even feel like they ran a marathon. And I think it's partly because we're fueling better and also the impact of super shoes.
Yeah, and like I've even seen that recently in like ultra running. Maybe when you take out the elevation and the downhill, the sort of up and down on like relatively flat courses, you know, seeing athletes that are fueling incredibly well and don't have extreme levels of muscle soreness after even these longer events because they've just been really like efficient with their fueling strategies and they're staying on top. And to your point, they're not digging a hole too deep. They're sort of staying in this realm of like, okay, I could, you know, keep going if I keep fueling. And I think it's particularly important if people haven't sufficiently like sort of carb loaded or fueled before, at least get some, you know, if you haven't had time, like we say, life gets in the way, other stressors, whatever else, at least if you haven't done a sufficient fuel in race or in training session, fueling can be really, really beneficial. And also I think there's recent evidence or sort of like discussions around even like gut training and having that as like, you know, thinking of the gut as a muscle and you can train it in preparation for, you know, those key races that you might have within a season.
I'll never forget reading about Des Linden, American marathoner, who was like throwing up on the side of the road as she was training her gut to take in these high carb fuels during a marathon training session. And, you know, she was like, well, this is just part of the process. I need to train my gut and eventually I'll be able to handle it and I'll be able to fuel better. But it is just this weird process that us runners go through. It's like, okay, we have to throw up a couple times trying to fuel these long runs. You know, you mentioned other stresses in our life. And this is one of the more interesting aspects of recovery that I think has emerged over the last, you know, maybe 10 to 15 years, is this idea that stress is stress and other things going on in your life are going to hormonally impact you in a very similar way as a hard training session. And this can be really hard for runners to manage because they don't have as much control over some of those outside stressors. So, like, how do you go about advising athletes on managing outside stress, trying to reduce it where possible, when it can be very difficult to do that?
100%. And it's a challenge and it is different for everybody. But I think one of the key strategies is like, if you have a coach or whoever you're programming with, it's part of that larger conversation. So if, for example, you've got like a marathon build for 16 weeks and, you know, your coach is prescribed sort of 2 peak weeks, you know, 8 weeks out, whatever the program might be. But you know, the week before that you've got a project deadline or it's the end of quarter in your job or there's something else. Like, I think that's the responsibilities on like the athlete and yourself to say, okay, like there are 2 peak stressors here and they're going to be competing for time. So something probably is going to give. And, you know, probably for most people, like if they have a job, that can't give, because that's how they provide, you know, they provide for their families and actually pay rent and mortgages and stuff like that. So I think it's trying to like make sure that you can adjust and be agile with, you know, maybe a training plan around it and say, okay, well, like, you know, the ideal peak week is this many weeks out from a competition or a race, but because you've got this other stressor or this known stressor that's there, like we're just going to peak maybe 2 weeks before then. And like, you know, you just have these like balances and compromises that happen within a program, and just being okay with knowing that, you know, oh, at the end of the day, and particularly long term, you're going to be a better athlete, but probably just a better human, if you've just balanced those stressors. Like, you know, if I know I've got a lot of exercise or activity and I've got a lot of work, you know, probably doesn't give you much time for anything else outside of that socially or like relationships, everything else. So it's just trying to make sure you're balanced and you're honest and having honest conversations across all of those different avenues.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it kind of gets back to this idea that, you know, you're probably not a pro runner and you've got to fit your life stressors around running rather than the other way around, or you need to fit your running around your life rather than the other way around. You know, this reminds me of, you know, I often give very specific Boston Marathon advice because of when the Boston Marathon is. You know, I usually tell runners, look, I know that you are going to be tapering for the Boston Marathon around the same time that your taxes are due. Don't think that you're going to have a great Boston Marathon experience if, you know, oh, I'm tapering, I'm not training as much, I can do my taxes, because you're, you know, you're probably just going to get stressed out in some way. And, you know, you don't take on a big project or something like that when you're tapering for a race. You try to just reduce the stress, keep your life super easy. You know, with where Boston is in April, it's like, don't try to do your taxes.
Yeah. It's funny. I did like a visual before, I think I shared online with Jonah, and we put as one of the sort of like chronic positive contributors to marathon performance as an accommodating lifestyle or an accommodating family. And, you know, of course, all the other things around like super shoes are important, like consistency of training, running economy, like all these other things. But at the end of the day, your lifestyle is an important factor for your marathon performance. If you have a partner or family or friends who, you know, support your running lifestyle, who can, you know, support with some of your nutrition or cooking and meals and everything else, like all those things do actually contribute to, you know, removing stress from you if running or marathon performance is one of your goals.
Of course, hindsight is 20/20, but when I look back on my college running years, of course I was able to run very fast. You know, like obviously I was a young man, my testosterone levels were sky high, but at the same time, all my meals were provided because I was on the college's meal plan. I didn't really have to worry about housing, you know, a lot of the big stressors in life. I just had class, running, and then I had fun, you know, on the other, you know, 20 hours of the day. And because I wasn't worrying about a lot of things, I just had so much space in my life for hard training. And I think the more we can try to do that as adults, the better runners we're going to be. But it is a difficult proposition, right? Because we can't quit our jobs and, you know, go live in a training house with four other runners in Boulder, Colorado, as much as we want to. You know, we've got to live actual real adult lives.
Definitely. I also think, like, you know, for marathon and for other sports and longer distances and everything else in between, there's always a mental or psychological component to those, whether that's like strategy or just like mental performance and preparation. And sometimes those other stressors can be good training for that psychological stress. You know, if you have to work a full day and then do really hard training in the evening, you know, there's some elements of that that you'll adapt from over time. So when it comes to, you know, a long event or multi-day event or a dense sort of field sport competition or whatever that might be, there's definitely some carryover, in my opinion, that, you know, like if you've had to deal with a lot of stresses, you know, through your life as well as training, that, you know, you become mentally stronger. It's the same way as you know, you plan for a physical program as well. There's definitely some link, in my opinion, to that.
Yeah, it's very similar to you get you get adjusted to certain levels of training psychologically too. So, you know, if you're currently running 30 miles a week, 60 miles a week just might seem like this mentally incomprehensible number. But someone who's running 90 miles a week might look at 60 miles a week and think that's like a vacation. And a lot of it is just in how you interpret it. You know, it's just what you're used to. And so you can gradually train yourself to not be so psychologically impacted negatively by a high training load or certain work stresses. You know, I'll never forget, I did a lactate threshold workout after I took the LSAT. And a lactate threshold workout is run a little bit more on feel. It's a little bit more physiological. It's not like a race-paced workout where this is my 5K pace, this is what I'm running the workout at. It's more based on how you're feeling, right? And my perceived effort was sky high, but my actual pace was slow. And it was this very visceral example of me just kind of being stressed out all day. And then I go and I try to do this workout and I'm not able to do it very well because I'm dealing with all that outside stress. And I think that was the first time in my life that I realized you can't do it all in one day and expect to be good at everything.
Definitely. And that's where some of the data like pace, heart rate, you know, other whatever else people are collecting can be useful, because it's providing an objective, I guess, like data stream that might just challenge your perception. Because you might say, no, like, I'm fine, I can power through this. And then your heart rate is 10 or 15 beats per minute higher than what it typically will be for that workout. And that's an eye-opening experience for some people who are like, you know, I feel fine. And then after the workout, you're like, well, wow, that was like, you know, so much harder from a heart rate perspective than that should be. And then that's the case where you're like, okay, I can't be digging myself into a deeper hole here. Like, maybe I should make tomorrow's a little bit easier, or even take a full, you know, non-training day, or can I remove other stressors from my life that, you know, or talk to your coach and say, okay, on a Thursday, I have a long work day. I can't do a tough workout on a Thursday evening. Like, I have to change it. And, you know, even though people fall into the trap of like, you know, doing a long run on this day and a track workout on this day and everything else, like, maybe that just doesn't work for people, and that's completely fine.
Yeah, it's funny. When I start working with a private coaching client, you know, I'll build them their first training plan, and I will say, how does this mesh with your life? Because often we'll have to kind of reconfigure things a little bit. And you're right, there's often one or two days a week that this person always has a ton of things scheduled and they're like, I can't get it done. Or if they can get it done, they just prefer not to because it's just too much psychological load. And that's where I'm like, yeah, well, let's make this your recovery day or a complete rest day. And that just works a lot better. Let's talk a little bit more about our final recovery strategy. And Peter, I was admittedly a little surprised to see this in your list of the big five, which was hydration. Why is hydration so important? We can afford to get a little dehydrated, can't we?
Yeah, it's funny. I did toy with like, oh, does it fit within nutrition as an overall like sort of concept within that bucket? And I think I'd shared something previously before, and I think some people had commented or questioned saying like, why did you separate out hydration and nutrition? And for me, I think like you can, they're related probably, as in if you're fueling well, there's a likelihood are that you're sort of well hydrated. But often I've seen in cases that isn't the case, where, for example, an athletes I've had have been carb loading really well, but have just not been drinking any fluids or any water. And so, of course, you can get sort of some elements of both. But I think there are situations where you can be dehydrated and well fueled, or vice versa, you can be under fueled, but like well hydrated. And so I think they sort of support each other in performance, firstly, but also recovery. And I think a lot of my thoughts, I'm still like, you know, hydration, electrolytes. I know there's some conversations around like electrolyte balance and stuff, and that's probably another deep dive for, you know, a different day. But I think where I sit with it is like, it's one of those really easy things just to tick off a list of principles. Like we say, okay, sleep, you know, training structure, all these things. Like there's elements to that you have to like readjust. We've talked about different scenarios of moving this for training and sleep, something happens and you're impacted. But hydration for me is just a really easy one that just drink some water consistently throughout the day. And for the most part, that probably appeases most of the hydration needs. I've also, my interpretation anyway, of some of the research and practice of some other coaches and researchers who've shared some insight online is, you know, particularly for those training twice a day, hydrating sufficiently between those sessions is just a really good way to make sure that you're recovered enough to do the subsequent session. And, you know, that's reflected in like HRV, but also just in like other readiness markers and stuff. So I think for me, it's just like a really easy one that I wanted to sort of try represent in those like key principles. Like these are just the big rocks. It probably sits within nutrition if we're being like sort of crude and like specific, but I just wanted to make sure it was like one of those ones that people can address really easily. And it's almost like hydrate so you're not diminishing performance. And that sort of in a full circle is helping with recovery as well.
What do you say to those runners who might say, well, I've heard that if I just drink water all day long, I'm going to be low on electrolytes. I'm not going to be absorbing any of this water. I'm just going to be peeing every 30 minutes. And it's just going to be kind of rinsing my body of all of the needed electrolytes that I need. And so I have to supplement with some sort of electrolyte. Is there any truth to that? Or you know, is there a balance between the two?
I think there's a balance between the two. Probably like everything we've talked about, there's a balance between everything. But it's always going to be so individual. It'll depend on your activity levels, like what type of sweater you are, how much you sweat during the day, but also during exercise, the climate that you're in, and the diet that you have as well. If you are eating foods that have high salt content, like that, you're probably getting quite a sufficient amount of electrolyte from food. So, you know, maybe you don't need to do it. You know, maybe there's situations where you're not and you should be. Sometimes, honestly, people just like electrolyte drinks because it just isn't water. It just is a nice way for, it's a vehicle or a method for them to actually just drink some more. And I don't think there's any harm in that. I think you can probably overdo it. And I think, you know, even on the label of a lot of products, they say like, you know, unless you're strenuously exercising, don't take, I think it's, you know, like two, depending on what it is, you know, like two of these a day or something. So there's probably that element as well of like, you can overdo anything. I mean, you can overdo hydration. You can definitely drink too much water. I think it's hard. Your body is remarkably good at sort of self-regulating. So if you start drinking too much, you'll just have to go to the toilet much more frequently. But the same thing with salt. I think, you know, your body is very good at taking what it needs. The same thing for sleep. Your body is very good at sleeping in stages that it needs based on, you know, what you've done in terms of strenuous activity. It might take more deep sleep or REM sleep, but, you know, as opposed to you trying to fixate on using the supplement to increase this part of sleep or this thing, you know, your body is just pretty good at doing those things itself.
Should runners really worry about drinking too much water? Because that seems like a problem that is almost never a problem. Like the cases of hyponatremia seem to be not very common, and they always seem to happen in races in very specific circumstances. So I'm just curious, like, is it almost an overblown fear a little bit? And the bigger fear is just being chronically dehydrated?
I agree. I think it probably is less of a problem than being dehydrated. So I'd probably lean towards, you know, drinking a little bit more. And like you say, those cases are relatively rare. Like, obviously, they can still happen. So, you know, I don't want to say endlessly drink, you know, gallons and gallons of water. Also, you know, if you're a runner and you are exercising, maybe those days that you're training, you probably need to increase the your fluid intake. On days that you might have a recovery day or rest day, you can maybe decrease it a little bit. And then depending on races and long runs, you know, if you just don't want a bathroom break, that's probably a consideration for you as well, to, you know, how quickly and how much you drink. But yeah, I do think it's important that everyone is aware that you can drink too much, but it usually isn't, you know, that's usually not the problem that people have. It's usually dehydration. And you can use urine color as a rough gauge of hydration levels. I mean, I think if it's extremely dark in color, that's obviously, you know, pretty well known that you probably need to drink a little bit more water. If it's completely clear, you know, maybe you're very well hydrated, but yeah, I wouldn't be too concerned of some of the fears that maybe some people have.
Let me tell you a slightly embarrassing story. My track team and I were running, we had a meet And I think it was either like not supposed to happen, but it did. And we were a little disappointed because we kind of wanted to go out and have too much fun and at the time. And so instead, we decided to have a party, but there was no alcohol. We only partied with water and we were playing beer pong with water. We were funneling water. I mean, we were just like a bunch of dumb kids kind of being funny. But I'll tell you, I did not feel good after that. And I probably drank half of what some of the other guys drank and they weren't feeling really good afterwards. So suffice it to say, don't have a party with just water and try to drink, 400 ounces of water, because you're not going to feel good.
Yeah. Well, it does like, I mean, bring up the point, which we haven't really discussed, and it's probably like a health concept more than anything, but like how you do things like eat and ingest fluid or nutrition is important. And, you know, I think we're probably all guilty of like inhaling some food just because we're under time pressure, but probably the better thing for your body is to like eat a little bit slower and chew your food properly and those kind of things. I think the same principle applies to water, is like, you know, try drink regularly throughout the day instead of, you know, 2 liters first thing in the morning and then like nothing else for the rest of the day. So yeah, probably what happened in that situation.
Yeah, I'm not going to be doing that again. Well, Peter, before we wrap for today, I'd love your thoughts on an idea. You know, I previously spoke with Christy Eschwanden. She's a health journalist who wrote a really amazing book called Good to Go on, you know, the recovery science that's out there. And she observed that recovery used to be something that happened in between training sessions when we were doing nothing. And now recovery seems to be something that we have to do if we want to get to our next training session. And I was just wondering on your kind of general thoughts on this idea that now recovery is a whole nother thing that we have to worry about, as opposed to back in the day when it was just like, this is just what your body does in between training sessions, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. And I haven't probably thought about it specifically like too much, but I think sometimes people are very aware now of what everybody else is doing. And so there's almost this level of anxiety that, oh, like Jason's doing like sauna after, or like he's eating this, or he's, I see him doing this recovery strategy and posting this. So like, should I be doing that? And it's like, well, then Jason's doing this and then Peter's doing this and then someone else. And then it's like, you get sort of overwhelmed with all of those things. So, I mean, there's, in probably a reductionist sense, it's probably no harm for some people to recalibrate and just do nothing between their training sessions and then add in some things to see if those strategies are having a positive effect on, you know, their recovery. So, you know, I don't want to say, you know, in the middle of a training block, drop all your recovery tools and do nothing and then start back. But if you're in a place where you feel like maybe you're spending too much money on certain things, or you're just feeling a bit overwhelmed, like certainly reducing a couple of, you know, maybe some of these recovery strategies are actually stressors themselves. And I think that can be the case, you know, like sauna is an example where probably less so from like a recovery perspective, but it is a stressor that some people forget about. You know, you're sitting there sweating. People think, oh, I'm just sitting here doing nothing. But that is, that has cardiovascular strain in your system and other stressors. And, you know, you need to be conscious of that from like a hydration perspective. But also if you're doing it before a training session the next day, you probably need to feel a little bit better and recover a little bit more than you would without doing the sauna. So sometimes some of these stressors can act as, or sorry, these recovery strategies can act as potential stressors as well. So it's an interesting concept though.
Well, I think it's interesting that of all the recovery strategies that we've talked about in this conversation, they're all things that are sort of passive, you know, like you have to eat and drink water, whether or not you're a runner. You're still going to go to sleep every night. You probably want to reduce stress in your life. So these are things that are not necessarily like active recovery strategies. It's more about how you live your life. And so there is probably a fair amount of truth to this, that the most important things you can do if you want to recover well from your training is just live a healthy lifestyle that's well structured and supports your running.
Yeah, I think so. And like the one thing I will say, maybe as well, as I definitely agree. And I think the more and more I'm like speaking to different athletes and coaches about recovery, there's a lot of focus on like the physical recovery. So whether that's like massage or like ice baths or like whatever the different tools and everything, even active recovery. But the psychological component is bigger, in my opinion. It's as important. And all of the athletes that I've spoken to, they always, when I talk to them about like, what is recovery to you? And I try to get some insight. Like, they all mention distinctly both physical and psychological components. And like we said, with everything, there's a two-way street. I think sometimes those physical recovery methods can unlock and support psychological recovery. But also on the flip of that, having psychological recovery can sort of, I think, support physical recovery. So sometimes if people just want to go do a cryotherapy session or do a float session or just do something that's a little bit different, often maybe the physical impact isn't as big, but the psychological recovery can be huge, and that can support then, you know, people recovering faster. So, you know, I definitely don't want to discourage using and exploring some of those new tools, because I think even socially, you do those with people, often the act of just not being on your phone and just being with friends or family can be like a really good recovery method. And that might just happen to be in a pool, you know, hydrotherapy or whatever it is, a massage parlor. So don't want to discourage those as well, but definitely those, like those big rocks are sort of, should be hopefully those consistent things that just happen as part of a good lifestyle practice.
You know, with you talking about psychological recovery, I want to ask you one final question. Might be slightly controversial, but my opinion after talking to a lot of younger runners, you know, college athletes, runners who are in their, you know, early to mid 20s, where they still want to have a social life and go out on the weekends and stay up late and drink some alcohol with their friends. I found personally that having that Saturday night, even when I was training really hard, was such an important psychological release for me, where for 6 days out of the week, really like 6.7 days out of the week, I was doing everything that we talked about. And I found that I just needed this little bit of time to not worry so much about optimizing everything. And I just wanted to have fun. And it's like the pressure built up all week long. And then, you know, I've got a little bit of a release valve on a Saturday night. So if I am talking to I've talked to college teams occasionally, I've talked to, you know, younger athletes, especially guys, and you're like, oh, is it really bad if I go out on a Saturday night and I have a couple beers with my friends? I tend to think it's important for the psychological recovery. And I also just like don't want to turn runners into these like health nut monks who never go out and kind of experience life. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that, if you think I'm totally off base or if there's something to be said about that.
100% agree. Something to be said for sure, if not to be encouraged, I think, having those sort of releases. And look, for some people and for most people, I do think that is social, whether that's meeting up with friends or, you know, if alcohol, you know, it's small doses of that, of course, like I think can be, no, I don't say alcohol is beneficial, but this, the scenario of being out with your friends, relaxing.
It's more social, right?
Yeah, the social benefits. And I mean, I've seen plenty of data from myself personally and other people who have seen like wearable data where they might go out for, you know, 3 or 4 drinks earlier in the evening with friends. And, you know, they don't have the typical response that you associate with an increase in heart rate, a decrease in heart rate variability. They actually have the opposite effect. And they're like, why is it? Oh, this wearable is a lot of crap. It doesn't work. And I'm like, well, I think it's just showing that, you know, you're somebody who actually responds really well to like those social situations. And I think that is really important. On the flip of that, I think I've posted some recovery sort of graphics before, and I put socializing as exactly how you described it, as a positive contributor to recovery. And I had a few people who sort of self-declared themselves as like, look, I'm very introverted. That would stress me out. If I had to socialize as part of my recovery strategy in a team sport, for example, like that, I would not be recovered. So it probably comes back, everyone is sort of like individual, but as a general principle, yeah, like as long as you find, whether it's like socializing or just reading or like whatever it is outside of your training program and your structured life, doing that to make sure that you're like psychologically recovered every week, 100%.
I love it. I love how we've kind of covered recovery from all these different perspectives and hopefully have given a more comprehensive view of what it takes to actually recover from hard training. Peter, is there anything I might have missed, any perspective or anything like that that you'd like to add about recovery?
I think we've touched on quite a lot. I think just like, yeah, that psychological aspect, and whether that's like mindfulness practices. And I don't mean everything has to be meditation. That can be one strategy. But some of those things, I think, you know, I didn't include necessarily in, like, in that graphic, I think, that we were talking about, I didn't include that as the big rocks of, like, time, sleep, nutrition. But within stress reduction, I do think some of those strategies have a definite place, particularly now in, you know, just how much noise and data and everything we're fed every day. I think having moments where you psychologically switch off, taking micro breaks, whether that's breathing, walking, you know, just not being in front of a screen. I think those things are really, really important. So maybe just so people are aware that, you know, those things fit within those bigger buckets of, or bigger bucket of stress reduction.
Yeah. And you share so much really helpful stuff. I'm going to include some links to your Instagram profile, but where else can folks learn a little bit more about your work and what you're up to? Because I think it could be super helpful for the athletes listening.
Yeah, mostly on Instagram. I post on Twitter a bit, or X. Sorry, it's been rebranded.
Whatever it's called.
And on LinkedIn. But I find Instagram, honestly, I actually have quite a... I learn a lot from people on Instagram as well. And often you'll see, I think what I post is not a final version by any means. If anything, it's a first version. And I often and always ask for feedback. And so, you know, if anybody does come across those, I definitely encourage you to try, you know, correct me where I'm wrong or add a viewpoint. And, you know, what you'll hopefully see is in time, you'll see an iteration of that visual or of my outlook as well. And, you know, that has been evolved from peers, coaches, athletes, other people contributing. So, you know, if you show version one of a visual that I've shared versus version four or five, you'll see it's consistent, but it has certainly evolved with the evidence, the anecdote from people as well. So Instagram's probably the best place to grab me.
I love that. I love the intellectual honesty of revising what you're publishing. That's fantastic.
The best example of that was I posted something about sleep before, and somebody said, like, you forgot caffeine as a negative. And I was like, well, yeah, I did. I obviously just didn't have enough caffeine in my system at the time of writing this. So it is a great place to get sense checked anyway.
Yeah. Well, I did notice something you posted recently about caffeine naps, which is not something I've ever tried, but that's probably another deep dive that we might have to go into. Waking up feeling stimulated and ready to go sounds like nirvana. It feels like the place you want to be. So we've got to explore that at some time. But until then, Dr. Peter Tierney, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jason.
What an episode. Thank you so much for listening and being part of our community here. If you're getting value from the Strength Running Podcast, if the show has helped your running or made you rethink how you approach your training, please consider leaving a review or a rating in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Those reviews are incredibly impactful and helpful for this small business. If you have questions about your running, feel free to email me at support@strengthrunning.com, or you can search our website at strengthrunning.com. For more digestible tips, videos, memes, and more, follow me on Instagram @JasonFitz1. We'll be in touch.